असतो मा सत्गमय, तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय, मृत्योर्मामृतं गमय। असतो मा सत्गमय, तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय, मृत्योर्मामृतं गमय। असतो मा सत्गमय, तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय, मृत्योर्मामृतं गमय। असतो मा सत्गमय, तमसो
Om, and welcome to all of you as we join each other for our first class in the great foundational text of the yoga tradition, the aphorisms on yoga of the sage Patanjali. And let's just start by acknowledging what a fraught time we're in, the circumstances under which we're gathering. You know, pandemics aren't new in the history of the world. Obviously, there have been plagues and pestilence everywhere since human beings first started living together, and they've always changed societies. The plague in Constantinople, I've been reading a little about the history of pandemics, partly because the press has been printing articles by historians about the history of pandemics. And for instance, the plague in Constantinople, in, I believe it was the 12th century or the 11th century, led to the takeover of the Eastern Roman Empire by the Ottoman Turks. The smallpox pandemics that were brought to the Americas by the Spanish conquistadors and the English settlers killed millions of indigenous people in Mexico, Peru, the Caribbean, and North America, and arguably facilitated the conquest of the Americas by the Europeans. So we are in our own version of what many social commentators believe is a truly world-changing situation, which will undoubtedly have radical effects on society for a long time to come. And like me, you're probably aware that the changes we're looking forward to are inevitable and that they could go either way. They'll probably be mixed. You know, they could bring us even more inequality and social alienation, or they could bring us more and more care and concern for the vulnerable and marginalized members of society, maybe even give rise in this country to an expanded healthcare system and other parts of the social safety net. We hope that it'll go that way, but we don't yet know how it will go. And the one thing we do know is that this is a time for yoga. It's a time for yoga in the very deepest sense of the word. Because the way we create, the way we cultivate a strong and compassionate inner state is essentially through yoga, through the practices that are necessary to transform the mind, not just to control it, but to actually transform it so that what we are able to live by is our deepest knowledge, our deepest love, and our deepest intuitive wisdom. The Yoga Sutras are perfect for this time because, like the Upanishads, like Vedanta, like Taoism, and many other traditions, practices that are core to our spiritual traditions actually came out of societies where life was really precarious, where physical suffering was a condition that pretty much everyone faced over and over again. And if, as most of you remember, Buddha's famous wake-up call came when he saw for the first time an old man, a diseased person, and a corpse. And he realized that even though he personally was leading a life of wealth and enjoyment and good health, that most people in the world were condemned to old age, sickness, and death, and that it would even happen to him. And it was out of this realization that his search for a path that would release not just him, but everyone from the pain of the human condition arose. So we're in the middle of a wake-up call like that. And because we have the privilege of practice, and because most of us here are living in parts of the world where we're really relatively privileged, where we have steady access to water and sanitation and fuel and education, so we're more equipped than many to see the transformative opportunity that's available to us, which can really help us turn hard times into real transformation. And this is what we're going to do in the next few weeks. So I want to say that the Yoga Sutras and we ourselves, when we practice, we do it with the intention to make our inner work be of benefit to others. When we cultivate our inner yogic wisdom and when we extend our hearts, we really do it so that we can create around ourselves a mandalas of sanity and strength that will flow not only towards our own hearts and minds, but also flow through us to the parts of society, the parts of the world that we touch. And to accomplish this, we really need to take very seriously the need to work with our own mind. So that's what we're going to do for the next 6 weeks and perhaps beyond, because one thing I've discovered is that when you begin to work with one of these texts, you never get through it in the first series of classes. There's so much wisdom and there's so much to learn that very often the first class ends up being followed by a second class and maybe a third class. So we might be doing this for a while, and some of you, I hope, will be doing it with me and with all of us together. So just a few housekeeping details. Along with these weekly lectures, we'll also have a couple of Q&A sessions, which will happen later in the course. Probably next week there'll be one, and maybe after the third week. You'll receive a homework assignment every week, which will have meditation instructions and also study guides, contemplation questions, different ways to inspire yourself to look deeply into what this text wants to show us. And we'll also be sending you some audio meditations. I also want to remind you that this class is very much enhanced if you have a study partner. So if you want a partner and you don't have someone in mind, shoot a note to Deb and she can set you up with someone in your time zone. And she asked me to remind you to make sure that you say in the email what your time zone is. And one more thing that audio download of the lecture will be available the day after the class. You'll be able to find it on the course page. And we also have a listserv, which is one of the, for many of us, one of the coolest things about these classes, because the community that forms can become very supportive. Some of you really like the listserv, to use the listserv. Some of you are not so drawn to it, and you can curate how involved you want to get in the listserv, whether you want to get all the mails that comes or just want to get a summary or don't want to participate at all. It's up to you. So there's a lot that we have to work with. And I know for me, when we engage in one of these text study satsang gatherings over a period of time, and I think for many of you, the wisdom that we're learning and studying really starts to express itself in our lives. And I would say that one of the special things about this particular time is that many of us are home. Some of us hyper-busy because of our kids or elders whom we're taking care of or just the demands of work. And yet, when we are in the house, when we're doing social distancing, it also gives us an opportunity for more retreat, longer meditation time, and it also might give us quite a bit of inspiration to work with our minds as things like cabin fever and the annoyance of spending more time with family members than we normally do might inspire us to actually do a little bit of self-inquiry into how our samskaras are making us feel. So it really is a huge opportunity. And one of the reasons that I chose the Yoga Sutras as study for this time is because it is so basic and foundational, and because it is such a kick-ass text for showing us the nature of our own mind. So let's continue by opening to the community. There are people here from all over the world, over 250 of us who are either here on the live call or who are present on the audio download. All of us, whether we're listening live or listening a couple of days from the live call, are very much contributing to the power that makes these classes serve our inner connection. And so right now we're going to gather the power of the community. One of the images that we use in these classes when we gather for one of these sessions is the image of being seated together around the clear waters of a holy lake. I always think of a legendary lake in the Himalayas. Actually, it's a real lake, it's a real place, but it has a lot of myth and story and sacred iconography attached to it. It's called Manasarovar, the Great Lake of the Enlightened Mind. So right now, close your eyes and find yourself in a grounded posture. Let the torso rise up from the grounded base, up through the crown. Focus for a moment or two on the flow of the breath, which we'll be coming back to again and again in the course of this class. And imagine that all of us are sitting around the lake in a circle on its edge, on the shore, facing into the deep blue clarity of what really is the lake of enlightened consciousness, from which we can all drink and from which, within which, around which, we can take refuge. So as you connect your mind to the breath that is the life force of the planet, the living Shakti whose nature is love, inhale with the sense that the breath connects the base of the body to the earth. And with the exhalation, feel that the breath opens and expands your heart. So inhaling, grounding through the base, feeling your sits bones and buttocks and thighs supported by the chair and by the earth, exhaling with this sense that the heart expands. Now sense the hearts of everyone here. Wherever we are physically, no matter what time and place our physical bodies are present in, we are all here together in the subtle world. And see if you can feel the connection between your heart and the hearts of everyone here. Sense the presence of the guides and lineage masters, of the different traditions that each one of us holds. Feel these subtle beings gathered around us and feel their intention for our unfolding awakening as individuals, as a community, and as a planet. Now imagine that you hold in your hands a candle. It's in a jeweled holder. And from your right forefinger, imagine that a flame springs up. It's like you have the superpower of being able to kindle a flame out of your finger and use this magical flame to light the candle. Hold the candle in your hand, in your cupped hands for just a moment, and place an intention into the candle. It can be something very simple, like, may my practice be of benefit to all beings. Or may this practice deepen my sadhana. May it help my family. May it allow me to know the truth of myself in a steady, constant way. And now place the candle on the surface of the lake. And feel that the lake now glows with the presence of hundreds of candles, all of them filled with the sacred intention of each one of us. And let the breath flow in and out of the heart with the thought, may our practice uplift me. May it carry me deeper into my journey of enlightenment. May this practice and study enable me to be of help to others. May this practice and study bring me joy. And may all beings benefit from what we are doing here together. And now we're going to invoke the presence of the two great aspects of reality, the underlying awareness, whom in our tradition we call Shiva, who is the inner teacher, and the underlying power of radical creativity and love, whom in our tradition we call Goddess or Shakti. We'll chant the invocation, which you should have on your chanting sheets, Om Namah Shivaya Gurave, Salutations to the Eternal Teacher who exists within us as pure being, pure awareness, and pure joy, who is peaceful, luminous, without form, who is never not supporting us. And then we'll chant to the goddess, taking refuge in she who is the auspiciousness of all that is auspicious, who is always one with Shiva, to Gaudi, the three-eyed shining one, Narayani, we bow. And we'll begin with three ohms, and you can bring your hands into Anjali Mudra. Om. 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 Om Namah Shivaya Gurave Sat Chitananda Murtaye Nishprapanchaya Shantaya Niralambaya Tejase. Sarva Mangala Mangalye Shive Sarvatra Sadike Sharanye Trayambake Gauri Narayani Namostute. And finally, I'm going to chant, as you will be in the following weeks, because we're going to send you an audio of this chant that you'll be able to learn, so you'll be able to learn the tune. This is a traditional chant invoking Patanjali, the author of this extraordinary text. We don't know if Patanjali was an actual being, but these sutras invoke him as such, and they invoke him as the Guru. Vande Gurunam Charana Ravinde Sandarshita Swatma Sukhava Bhode Nishreyase Jangali Kayamane Samsara Hala Hala Moha Chantye Abahu Purushakaram Shankha Chakra Siddharanam Sahasrashirsasam Svetam Pranamami Patanjalim. I bow to the lotus feet of the Gurus, the awakening happiness of one's own self revealed, supremely good, acting like the jungle physician. The jungle physician is a mythical character who is considered to be the wild source of spontaneous healing. Acting like the jungle physician, pacifying delusion and dissolving the poison of samsara, taking the form of a man-serpent, half man, half snake, holding in his forearms a conch, a discus, and a sword, having 1,000 heads, white in color, to Patanjali I bow. And with these words, we invoke the grace of eternal, omniscient, endless power of grace and wisdom, the power of Shakti, who alone can liberate us from our tendency to see everything within ourselves through a prism, an imprisoning prism of samskaras and vasanas. And we offer our salutations to the inspired author of these sutras. And for just a moment, sit with the feeling that your breath is drawing in grace. It's drawing in wisdom. It's drawing in connection to the source of deep knowledge. Knowledge that comes from the earth itself. Knowledge that is encoded into every human body and every human heart. The inhalation draws in particles of liberating grace just by the mere act of breathing. You draw it in through your nostrils, and with the exhalation, you allow that sense of grace to expand through your body. So the Yoga Sutras is a very complex and profound text, but at one level, and this is where we're going to start today, it's the most basic manual for yoga practice, for essentially meditation practice, as well as being an extremely subtle guide to the states that arise in us when we practice meditation. One of the core realizations that the sages of the yoga tradition really understood is that the skills we develop in meditation are the basis for everything and anything we're doing in our practical lives, our off-the-mat lives. So here's the 101, and this class is the 101 of the 6-part Yoga Sutra series. The bottom line, when you follow these meditation protocols, your consciousness changes. That's what they're meant to do. And part of what the sutras tell us is that if you aren't willing to follow this practice path, then that alchemical miracle won't happen in the same way. And that's because the underlying wisdom, the intuitive capacity, which the yoga tradition calls pratibha. Pratibha basically means intuition, but not just intuition in the sense of gut feeling, but really the intuition that comes from the source, that comes from the self. That capacity, which we all have, comes online through yoga. And the truth is that no matter how smart and accomplished you are, no matter even how psychic you are, you don't really get that wisdom without yoga. Unless you practice to calm your mind, unless you learn to focus your innate intelligence, then even when wisdom, when intuition arises, you won't necessarily believe it, because you won't necessarily be able to distinguish the intuitive wisdom from what your mind is telling you. And that is one of the most practical reasons why it's so important to work with these instructions, because following these meditative protocols will create in each of us a capacity for moving in the inner world that will eventually bleed into our outer lives. This wisdom, the wisdom that we access, the wisdom that I hope will become more and more available to you through this study, not just now, but over the years to come, is not personal. It's actually the wisdom of the Atman, the wisdom of the divine self. We simply liberate this wisdom through practice, and it's what lets us discover the real nature of the inner and outer world. And I say this with full conviction because I've seen it in myself and so many of the people I know. I've watched people transform from scattered, fearful, self-centered, you know, postmodern beings into wise women and wise men who have immediate access on nearly all occasions to this subtle wisdom that's deeper than thought. I know personally when I began meditating, I literally could not hold my mind steady for 2 minutes at a time. Maybe 2 minutes is long. Maybe it was less than a minute. And now, whenever I have a question about anything, I can turn inside, get quiet, and find that answers surface almost immediately. So one of the first truths that Patanjali wants to give us is that we don't get to that place without calling ourselves constantly on our own bullshit about practice. So one of the main characteristics of a text like this is that it holds up a mirror in which we can see both our greatness and our illusions. So the Yoga Sutras measures our state, measures our accomplishment, as you will, by our ability to hold the mind steady. And I want to say right off the bat here that the ability to hold the mind steady is a characteristic of anyone who's successful in life, whether you're an athlete or a doctor or just a good student, a writer or an artist, or, you know, an accomplished accountant. You need to be able to hold your mind steady to do anything well. But that's, while very helpful, it's not exactly the same thing that Patanjali is talking about. One of the great monastic commentators on this text says this: the ability to stop at will the fluctuations or modifications of the mind, which is acquired through constant practice in a spirit of renunciation, is called yoga. So yoga is not, it's not the asana practice. It's your ability to get still in the practice. It's not the fact that you sit for meditation. It's that you're able to get still in the meditation. And this definition actually offers us a high bar. And it takes quite a lot of practice to get there. He goes on to say, the two important features of yoga are that there is suppression at will of the modifications of the mind, and that it's not casual, but has been developed into a habit through constant practice, done without the desire for egoic gain. The heart of yoga, of the Yoga Sutras, is training in concentration, which is also the title of the first chapter, which is called Samadhi Pada, or the word pada means state or resting place. Samadhi is the word we're going to define in great detail next week, but it essentially means full concentrated absorption. And I have to say that every time I read these sutras, I'm struck by how important it is not to settle for less than full concentration. And so I'm inspired to take my practice more seriously. The Shiva Sutras, which many of you have studied with me in the last few months, inspire us by showing us the expansive power of our own spirit, by showing us basically our oneness with the divine. The Yoga Sutras inspire us by showing us that that expansion only becomes lasting if we practice, and then gives us such a wealth of state-changing tips and practices and techniques that we basically can approach concentration from so many different angles that we are bound to find one or two or three or four that really float our boat. And that's one of the reasons why the Yoga Sutras are so significant and why they're so much a part of pretty much every yoga tradition. So I want to start with an overview, because that's the traditional way of beginning a text. You start with the context, the lineage, and then you give an overview of the goal and the methodology. I've recommended a couple of translations and commentaries, and you can find those recommendations on the list, on the course page. I'm basing my initial reading of the sutras on a version translated by Pandit Rajmani Tigganayat of the Himalayan Institute. One of the reasons I like this version is because it has a word-by-word translation and transliteration of the Sanskrit, so it's pretty easy to read for someone who doesn't read Sanskrit in the original. But another reason I like it is because the commentator is a tantrika. He's from a South Indian Sri Vidya Shakta tantric tradition. So his viewpoint is very similar to mine. I want to say a little bit about that. The conventional view of the classical yoga tradition of the Yoga Sutras is that it's dualistic. And, you know, it's based on a very august old philosophy called Sankhya. And Sankhya emphasizes the separation between pure consciousness, which it calls Purusha. Purusha means man, but it also means person. And it's Purusha in the language of this tradition actually means the true person, which is to say the self, which we're going to call the Atman or the self throughout this course rather than the Purusha. The idea in Sankhya, and it's at the heart of the Yoga Sutras, the Yoga Sutra is not a metaphysical text at all, but it's based on some metaphysical principles, one of which is that the goal is to detach your consciousness, the true self, the inner witness, from any kind of entanglement with the objects of consciousness, which include your own thoughts. And it's important when you understand this, not to turn this distinction into the idea consciousness is good, thoughts are bad. Obviously, as any tantrika knows, every part of our human experience and the world itself is sacred, and every part of it is helpful on the journey. However, when we follow this practice to disentangle pure consciousness from everything else, it actually really helps us work with the causes of our suffering, which, generally speaking, are the thoughts, the vrittis, as they're called in Sanskrit, the samskaras, which are the deeply rooted habit patterns which our thought, our habitual thinking create in the field of consciousness, and from the vasanas, which are the deepest aspect of the samskaras, the incredibly deeply rooted tendencies that create our character and most of the strengths and weaknesses that we experience as individuals. So the real power of this vision is not that it asks us to reject anything in our experience. It's that these teachings really, really help us make that fundamental distinction between the self and the mind, which allows us to get very deep into meditation. And by practicing with these sutras, we actually start to change the field of the citta. Citta is the Sanskrit word for mind field. And the Sanskrit word citta, as many of you know, has the same root as the word chit, which is the Sanskrit term for pure consciousness itself. The understanding here is that citta, the individual mind field, is made of the same stuff as chit, the universal consciousness, which is the field and source within which everything in this universe arises. So the citta is a sacred creative force. And as you get to know your mind, and as many of you have done, as many of you have learned in the course of your practice, when you get to know your own citta, your own mind, you realize that it is indeed infinitely creative. It's capable of pretty much anything. And part of our yoga practice is to allow ourselves to liberate this incredible power of the mind. So in our normal state, you know, in our normal state, the citta is kind of velcroed to the thoughts and impressions that we hold. And one of the initial goals of yoga practice is to make our mind feel more like Teflon, you know, so that it can throw off these thoughts and impressions, which is what the commentator means when he says to suppress the modifications of the mind at will. It's not that what we want to do is tamp down our thoughts, is, you know, beat up our mind. It's that we want to make our mind so flexible that, you know, that it can let go of anything that comes up that we don't want to hold on to. Because in our normal state, again, this is 101, but it is it's important to reiterate it. You know, this our normal state, which the yoga texts basically call the state of bondage, we are not just Velcroed to our emotions, opinions, and ideas. We define ourselves all the time according to what we're thinking and feeling. So, you know, every time you say, I'm tired, or I'm an artist, or I just did something so stupid, you're expressing that basic misperception of identity. You're literally confusing your identity, your real self, with a passing state in the body or an emotion or an activity. And, you know, there are traditions, and, you know, I actually have some friends who practice in this way who refuse to use the word I about themselves, so they won't say I'm tired. They'll say tiredness is present. I personally find that a little bit annoying, but it does express what the realization that we come to as we do these practices, which is that I, the real self, is not touched by experiences of tiredness or by emotions like fear and anger. It is really free, and free to watch anger and fear passing through. So the fact is that every time we kind of surrender to our tendency to identify with what the texts of Vedanta call the coverings of the self, the vrittis, the samskaras, the vasanas, we are ensuring that we'll continue being limited by what we think we are, and therefore our future will be very much like our past. Someone said to me recently, the greatest slavery is the slavery to the belief that the future is going to be like the past. It's an interesting statement, but it's also a description of what we ensure for ourselves when we're not able to free ourselves from the samskaras. So it's obviously much easier to practice with our tendencies if we can step away from the idea that thoughts and opinions are you, are me, are us. And really the superpower of the Yoga Sutras is that it enables us to do this. I also want to point out that a lot of the concepts that we come across in the Yoga Sutras are applicable to many different metaphysical paradigms and philosophical positions. So we're going to come across words like Purusha, Prakriti, the three gunas, the division of the mind field into functions like the sense mind that gathers impressions from the outside, the ego tendency to identify me and not me, the intellect, the buddhi, which allows us to discern. All these are part of the vocabulary of every system that was born in India, including Tantra, Vedanta, and even Buddhism. So, and when I first began studying Patanjali, I came to it from studying Tantric, non-dual Tantric Shaivism, which is a very, very high and inspiring set of metaphysical understandings, which really, really changed my sense of who I am and what a human being is and what the world is, but didn't really give me the step-by-step. So when I came to the Yoga Sutras years later, I was just allured by how granular and practical they are. But they really bring you down to earth. So, and they show you that there's no point in talking about non-duality unless you can focus. And it's because the Yoga Sutra emphasizes so much the power of focusing the mind internally, showing us how to turn the mind inward in meditation, that it's sometimes called the scripture of the royal path, which is called Raja Yoga, where we aim for the highest goal to merge the mind in its source, pure consciousness. So this path was created by hardcore yogis, highly focused meditation practitioners, people who really dedicated their life to practice. But even though they were hardcore, they particularly understood that meditation is not just what you do when you close your eyes. They also give you access to a tremendous amount of skill and power. And the Yoga Sutras has an entire chapter devoted to how you use meditative skills to give you access to anything and everything that you need to know. In fact, what Patanjali wants to show us, above all, is how to look at the mind to understand how the mind creates suffering when it alienates itself from its source in pure awareness, but how the mind also can create exquisite beauty and extraordinary acts of creativity once it learns how to touch the source. So let's just take a moment to find our grounded posture. Feel the connection between the buttocks and thighs and sit bones. And the seat. And I want to meditate in this moment on ground. So imagine that you're sitting inside a Pilates ball made of air. We could call it an imaginary Pilates ball, but just as a Pilates ball will support you in a very bouncy fashion, this imaginary Pilates ball also allows you to sit in a way that gives great lightness. See if you can bring your attention to the very base of your posture, to the coccyx, to the perineum, which is that little knob of flesh between the anus and the sexual organ. And then bring your attention below the body and have the feeling that you're in connection to the subtle element of earth. You know, just as human beings have a subtle aspect, what the yogic texts call a subtle body, the earth has a subtle aspect. And the subtle aspect of earth is innately grounding and nourishing. So with the inhalation, feel as though the breath is drawing up energy from the subtle earth, drawing it up into your lower body so that your hips, your thighs, your belly, your whole body below the navel is infused with earth energy, which has the qualities of nurturance, of nourishment, of solidity, of ground, of support, of presence. And with the exhalation, see if you can breathe these qualities all through your body. So you're breathing in the nourishing energy of subtle earth, and you're exhaling, allowing that nourishing, grounding quality to flow through your entire body, from your belly up to the crown of the head. So as I describe what the mythological understanding of who Patanjali was, see if you can keep your awareness in that space where the inhalation draws your attention below the body into the subtle earth, to feel its support, and then to draw that support up into your body. Even though we don't know if Patanjali was actually a person, whether the name Patanjali is the name of a sage or a group of sages, he is nonetheless contemplated, invoked, and worshipped as a particular being. One of the meanings of the two syllables Pata, which are the first syllables of his name, is falling leaves. And Anjali, of course, the last three syllables of his name, refers to the mudra of devotion and prayer, which we practice a lot, in which the hands are cupped over the heart. So the name Patanjali means one who reverently receives the wisdom that falls like leaves from the higher realms. And this points to the claim that this book is not the work of a human mind, but that it actually is channeled. It comes from higher wisdom. It was heard. The Sanskrit word is Shruti, by a devoted practitioner. So actually the teacher who unfolded the wisdom of yoga and who taught Patanjali was the teacher whom we invoked at the very beginning of the class, because the wisdom of yoga is said to come from Shiva, who is described as the eternal guru. Another meaning of Pata is snake, specifically the divine snake Ananta, who is said to live in the very center of the cosmos and to uphold the world. So Ananta is the support of the world, which is why we did this meditation on subtle earth, because it actually invokes the support that is at the heart of where the Yoga Sutras comes from. So Patanjali's iconic form is that of a man's upper torso with a serpent's tail. And if you're familiar with Indian mythology, you know that Vishnu, the sustaining power of the cosmos, is often said to sleep on a bed formed by Ananta's coils floating in the ocean of consciousness. So Patanjali is somehow associated with Vishnu, with the sustaining power of the universe. And we could say that yoga is the sustaining power of the universe. So Patanjali is sometimes shown with four hands, two of them in Anjali Mudra, the third holding a chakra, a wheel that represents the cycle of life, the other holding a conch, which stands for the infinite space within which creation is formed. The four chapters of the Yoga Sutras, which are called padas, the word pada means state or resting place, are arranged in a sequence, and they start with the highest goal of the text, which is characteristic of all of these texts, because it's the tradition in Eastern philosophy to always begin with the very highest understanding that the scripture is pointing to. We start with the highest, partly so that it shows us where we're going, and partly because the sages believed that if you're a very advanced seeker, you can get the whole thing from reading the first sutras. So book one is called Samadhi Pada, that is the book of full absorption in the self. And the first three sutras of the Yoga Sutra actually describe the highest state of yoga, which we're going to get into in just a moment. Book one, Sutra 2, defines yoga as Yogacittavritti Nirodha, one of the most famous sutras in the whole yoga tradition. It means, this is Pandit Rajmani's translation, complete mastery over the roaming tendencies of the mind is yoga. The citta vrittis, the modifications or fluctuations or movements of the mind, must be mastered. The word nirodha means, it's usually defined as cessation or suppression. In other words, one interpretation of this sutra is that yoga is an absolutely quiet mind. And the next sutra describes the result of that. Tada drishta swarupe vastanam. Then the seer, the witness, becomes established in its essential nature, which is pure consciousness. And sutra 4 then takes us right into the maelstrom of ordinary life. And it goes, vritti swarup yamita retra. Otherwise, the seer is identified with the roaming tendencies of the mind, which is pretty much the condition of an ordinary person. So this is the beginning, and we're going to go into that in more detail in a few minutes. The rest of the text unpacks, the rest of this chapter unpacks this insight, telling us a whole series of techniques for stilling the mind, but also giving us a step-by-step description of how the mind gets absorbed in samadhi, which we are going to go into in great detail next week. I have to say that when I first read this text, that first sutra, yoga is the complete suppression of the roaming tendencies of the mind, I went, oh my God, this is not possible. This will never happen. And I related much more, as some of you may also, to the descriptions of the bound state of the causes of suffering, which are in the second book, which is called Sadhanapada, the chapter on practice, which contains a description of the causes of suffering called the kleshas, and also of the very famous sequence of the Eightfold Path, the eight limbs of yoga. Chapter 3, which is called Vibhutipada, or the Book of Supernatural Powers and Yogic Skills, is about the fruits of yoga, but it essentially describes a technique called samyama, which is a highly focused practice in which you learn how to concentrate on anything from the essence of the heart of another person to learning how to conquer hunger and thirst, to acquiring all kinds of powers, such as being able to, you know, to become large and extremely large and extremely small. It really is the technique for accessing your own superpowers. And I would say that the techniques in this chapter, chapter 3, are the source of a lot of contemporary yoga wisdom about using your mind to manifest desires. A lot of modern New Thought practices, although perhaps they're not aware that they're based on the Yoga Sutras, but they actually mirror this understanding. And the fourth chapter, Kaivalyapada, or the Book of Total Freedom, describes the experience of an enlightened yogi, but it also explores karma, the nature of karma, the nature of how samskaras become character and destiny, and the play of the three gunas. It's essentially about the journey of an advanced yogi, and it tells us that yoga is an unending process of development. It's not something that, you know, that ends when we reach the apparent goal. So here today, we're going to concentrate on the first four sutras, go into them in some detail with meditation. So the first sutra states our intention. Atta Yoga Nushasanam. Now commences the instruction in yoga, which is essentially the setting of our internal posture. So this sutra, which we tend to overlook, I mean, it just says, okay, now we're going to start talking about yoga. But actually, what it says is that this is the moment when we step into sacred time and sacred space. Atta means now, but in a particular sense, it means atta in the sense of the eternal present. And atta in the tantric tradition expresses the fact that when we receive this knowledge, we are receiving it from the inner guru who lives in the topmost center of the body, in the Ajna Chakra, the region above the palate. Atta, in fact, is a signal that we're being guided by the Shakti, the power of consciousness. Because in the inner esoteric tantric tradition, all sacred knowledge comes through the awakened Kundalini Shakti. And the word Atta is associated with a triangle made of light that is seated in the topmost chakra, in the Ajna Chakra, in what is called a part of the upper regions of the human subtle body. It's called the Guru Chakra. And the triangle is represented by the letters A, Ka, and Ta. So it's called the Akata Triangle. And those of you who have studied Kundalini lore will be familiar with it. So it's the seat of the primordial inner guru. And the wisdom that comes from the topmost chakra and reveals itself through the sutras is the wisdom that actually allows us to transcend our merely human condition and reveals to us our union, the union between our individual self and what's called the Paramatma or the Supreme Self. So, Sutra 2, Yogaschitta Vritti Nirodaha. Yogaschitta Vritti Nirodaha. It's actually, as those of you who like to chant Sanskrit know, there's a certain power in chanting the verse itself. Yogaschitta Vritti Nirodaha. The word chitta, which as we said earlier, comes from the same word root as the word chit, meaning creative consciousness, the source of all, has also another meaning. The chitta, the individual mind stuff, is actually the actual self of a human being is the chitta. So, in other words, as an individual human being, your experience of yourself is the experience of your own chitta. The state of your mind is the state of your experience. Your entire life experience at every level is determined by the state of your mind field. So we're going to start examining the components of the chitta, and of course we're going to do it in meditation. So you might want to stand for a moment and shake yourself out. And you can reseat yourself if you've stood up and find your posture, check your posture. Once again, feel the connection between the sits bones and hips and buttocks, thighs and buttocks, and the seat. And see if you can sense the connection of your lower body to that subtle Pilates ball, which is the subtle body of earth. And let yourself feel grounded in earth. And now, as you inhale, just let the breath flow down the body and connect you to the ground. And then as you exhale, let the breath flow upward and inspire your torso to rise up from this grounded base through the crown. The shoulder blades release onto the back. Chest lifts and opens. You're in a steady, comfortable posture, a meditative asana. And now you allow your awareness to come to the breath, letting the breath be natural, just noticing it as it passes in and out of the nostrils. Sense the breath as it flows through the nostrils, passing the bridge of the nose inside the nasal cavity, flowing up through the nasal cavity, up into the center of the head. You know, there is a passage that leads from the nostrils up through the back of the throat and touches that region above the upper palate, which we call the Ajna Chakra or the sixth chakra. So as the breath flows in, you see if you can feel it flowing through the nostrils, flowing across the bridge of the nose inwardly and the inside of the nose, flowing up the back of the throat to the center in the middle of the head, and then flowing back downward through the nostrils. Enjoy the breath as it moves in this way. See if you can notice how as the breath flows out, there's a sense of opening and release. See if you can open to that flow of expansion with the exhalation. And begin to recognize that as you allow the natural exhalation without tightening or pushing, there might be a natural sense of stillness or release at the end of the exhalation. There's no attempt to draw the breath in forcibly or push it out. It's a very soft, natural inhalation and exhalation. But just begin to notice this fraction of a moment at the end of the exhalation where there's a kind of opening, a kind of release, a kind of stillness that naturally arises. It's part of the gift of joining the mind with the breath. Now as thoughts come up, which of course they will, notice them. Be aware of them. Some of these thoughts will be so subtle that they won't even be fully formed thoughts, more like pre-thought thoughts or seeds of thought. Notice also that if you get caught by a thought, that thought can actually flow out with the exhalation, and that moment of stillness can be the result of that intention to just let the thoughts flow out of the body. So be with the breath. Notice that there are parts of this process where you're very aware of thinking or of whatever agitation may be present, whatever restlessness may be present. But there are also parts of the process where there's stillness. You're not looking too hard. You're not trying to analyze it. You're just being very present to this extremely normal experience. Of anchoring the mind to the breath, noticing thoughts, allowing them to dissolve with the exhalation. Now see if you can notice. Now we're going to get a little bit more observant and granular. See if you can notice that there are basically four parts of this experience. First, there's the movement of the breath. Secondly, there's the moment of stillness, the second of stillness. See if you can become aware of that, the breath moving, the moments when stillness arises. And there's a third part, which is the thoughts, the thinking, the vritti. And yes, the breath is a vritti also. But as we're going to see later, some vrittis are skillful, yoga-friendly vrittis, and some less so. So the breath is a very yoga-friendly vritti. There's the breath. Movement of the breath. There's the movement of thoughts. There's the flash of stillness. And then there's the part of your chitta that's aware of thinking. And all of these are going on simultaneously. The breath is moving. Thoughts are arising and subsiding. Stillness is present and then covered by thought. But see if you can be really present to that which knows that all this is going on, to the inner witness, to the knower of your experience. See if you can keep your mind merged with the breath, following the breath and its path through the nostrils, passing underneath the bridge of the nose, up through the nasal cavity, into the center of the head, and then gently flowing outward. See if you can be aware of the stillness. And of course, of the thoughts. And let's try to, in a very gentle way, become more aware of the felt sense of this knowingness, this observing presence. And we'll do it by inquiry. What is it that knows your thinking? Not looking for a verbal answer, but just using the question to point out that part of your citta. Which is actually aware of your experience, the breath, the thoughts, the stillness. Even if you're zoning out, there is that which is aware. Let your attention sense the presence of that awareness. The point is not to turn this into an intellectual game or a search, but simply to allow your attention to cycle between awareness of breath, awareness of thinking, awareness of those flashes of stillness. An awareness of that which knows all this is being experienced. Again, what is it that knows you're meditating? What is it that knows the breath is moving? This is a glimpse of the drashta, the seer. And as you sit in meditation over a period of time, the flow of breath becomes more stable and regular. Thoughts arise, but they're less sticky. There might be a little bit more stillness. An awareness, if you're paying attention to it, actually begins to come more forward, come more present. And I'm going to ask who I'm going to talk about this, and I realize that my voice is creating vrittis, so please bear with me, because as I give these pointing out instructions, you don't want to let them disturb your process, but rather help make it a little bit more targeted. Seeing the seer, seeing the awareness, it's very subtle because you can't really look at it directly. And yet by asking, where is it? What is it? You invite the seer to come forward. And even a momentary resting in it, resting in the seer, is going to change your relationship to that which is the deepest truth behind the mind. As the chittavrittis become more quiet, the seer begins to recognize itself. And the more quiet the chittavrittis become, the more the seer begins to comfortably rest in itself, and the more you're able to identify yourself as that awareness. But part of the reason that we're doing this particular practice is to show ourselves, to let ourselves experience the fact that most of the time, as Sutra 4 says, the awareness is covered, identified with the thoughts, with the movement of the breath, and with whatever else is coming into awareness. So the seer is not fully conscious of itself. Maybe for a moment or two, and that's a really great thing. And that's going to expand your consciousness right now. Consciousness, the seer, is awareness itself. It's an infinite intelligence. It's unchanging. It holds the entire field of experience, not only for us, but for everything. And it has the innate genius of the source itself. But when it's identified with the samskaras and the body and the senses, these activities veil its radiance. So the seer can no longer see itself directly. It can only see what the mind shows it, and that's really significant. The seer can only see what the mind shows it. So because the states of the mind, the impressions of the mind and the emotions have become Velcroed to the seer, consciousness is in disguise. And again, I want to come back to this. When the seer is colored by the vrittis, and vrittis are not just thoughts, my voice is a vritti. Your experience of your physical body is a whole collection of vrittis. What you see when you open your eyes, what you hear, all of these are vrittis, and they're all disguising the pure consciousness of the seer, which is the inner essence of your mind. And what that means is that we're only able to see ourselves through the filters of the vrittis, and on an even deeper level, through the samskaras, which are the impressions left by repeated vrittis, and by the vasanas, which are the deep, deep habits and tendencies. So essentially, our life experience, which potentially is a complete loving clarity, open to whatever comes through. Our life experience is determined by our emotional tendencies. And that's why the heart of yoga is mastery of the citta vrittis. They have to be refined by the processes of focus on the highest truth. So if you watch your mind, and we're going to do this in a moment, without trying to do anything about it, what you probably notice is that thoughts come up without our willing it. So just right now, if you can, for 30 seconds, we're just going to sit, not paying attention to the breathing, not trying to do a yogic process, not being aware of awareness, just watching the mind. Notice that you don't have to do anything to make thoughts arise. They just arise. They just happen. They just surface. And they're mostly random, even though, of course, we are capable of structured thinking and problem solving. But mostly they just arise. And what you start to realize as you start to examine them, and I'm going to ask you to do that this week during the homework assignment, is that you start to realize that certain of these vrittis, certain of these thoughts are connected to emotions, and the more intense the emotions, the more charge they have, and the more charged emotions move through your mind, the more they stick, and the more they become habitual. And essentially, the samskaric patterns in the mind dictate what we're capable of thinking. You know, I'm just going to give you a personal example. As I said earlier, I'm a little sick, and it's not a big deal, but I have a history of childhood illness and a certain amount of chronic tendency to get sick. And as a result, I have a lot of samskaras around, you know, feeling physically vulnerable, feeling that I have to take care of myself because I could get sick any time and blah, blah, blah. And I also have a lot of some scars that I've developed in order to live a normal life while having a tendency to get sick. So, you know, there are some scars of being sick. I have defined my life in many ways, and they kind of limit me in certain ways. The some scars of self-care, however, have given me a lot of expertise, let's say, in enhancing wellness, you know, in learning what needs to be done to keep myself well, and these are pretty positive. And, you know, they give me confidence that I can protect myself and my immune system, which is actually pretty helpful in a pandemic. You know, I know what to do to stay strong. So I want to ask you, and it's going to be in your homework assignment, to take a look at the samskaric patterns that are really characteristic of you, that define you, and to start to recognize what a mixed bag they are. You know, that one set of samskaras tells you that, you know, that you're strong and talented and beautiful and, a good mother. Another set tells you that you're unlovable or that, you know, that nobody really cares about you. And, you know, there are almost infinite number of samskaras that human beings can hold. And each of them is based on a deeper set of tendencies which represent the thinking patterns, the habitual patterns that you've held over lifetimes, which in Sanskrit are called vasanas. And the movement between these samskaras, which is pretty much endless, is called the Vritti Samskara Chakra. The Vritti Samskara Chakra, the wheel of thoughts and deep impressions. Thoughts create emotions. Emotions have charge. They get lodged in the mind, ready to emerge when circumstances trigger them. So the wheel of Vrittis and Samskaras feeds each other, and most of our life is simply a dance between the two. One of the gifts that the Yoga Sutra gives us in the commentary on Sutras 6 through 12, actually, is a catalog of the major mental functions at which determine the types of vrittis that we are able to hold. And they fall into five categories. And the truth is, and I've examined this a lot, and not only me, but some highly experienced practitioners have examined it. Pretty much anything you think, anything you feel, falls into one of these categories. Some of these mental modifications are neutral. These are called aklishta, which literally means not painful. Some of them are highly charged and pretty painful. Those are called klishta. So part of, you know, what we try to do in life is focus on the non-painful samskaras and eliminate the painful ones. But of course, it isn't always possible because we don't have control of our Vritti Samskara Chakra. So here they are. I'm going to give you the list and a little explanation and invite you to examine them on your own as you look at the sutras this week. So the first category is called correct understanding. Right understanding. And right understanding, correct understanding includes factual knowledge, knowledge based on factual reality. It also includes the spiritual testimony of realized beings, insights that come from intuitive knowledge of truth. Right now, this issue of correct understanding, correct knowledge during the pandemic is a really big deal. Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, has become, you know, kind of the hero of the pandemic response in the U.S. I was deeply impressed by Angela Merkel's address a couple of weeks ago about the pandemic in Germany. Both of these leaders are giving correct information as best they can. And one of the things that they're saying is, I don't know everything. You know, we don't know everything. So part of correct information is being able to say we don't know. And of course, correct knowledge, correct understanding is the source of all of our modern scientific knowledge. it's a tremendously important, and it's one of the reasons why vrittis are so useful in life. And in spiritual life, the right knowledge is the knowledge that actually enhances our practice. So then the second vritti is false knowledge, which God knows we have a lot of exposure to these days. So every new conspiracy theory, new fake cure for diseases, new alternative fact, new internet rumor, lies, delusions, you know, all sorts of fake information all come into this. Our president of the United States is pretty much a master of false information, but he's not the only one. So the third category is called vikalpa, which means imagination, and it means vikalpas are vrittis that are entirely rooted in the mind itself. And, you know, actually, I love vikalpa, and you know, I use vikalpa a lot in my practice because imagination is, of course, the source of art. It's the source of fiction, and it's also a very powerful source of practices that can, in fact, enhance our ability to come close to the self. And it's also the source of the kinds of fantasies that just take us away from real life. The other day, a friend of mine called me from Miami. The pandemic's coming to Florida, and he said, you know, I was thinking, suppose I get really sick and suppose I have to go to the hospital. I wonder if my friend X, who's very connected to one of the, you know, who's on the board of one of the big hospitals, I wonder if he'll be able to get me a ventilator. And then I thought, oh, but, you know, if he gets me a ventilator, it'll mean taking it away from somebody else, and maybe that person needs it and deserves it more. So I'm in a dilemma. Do I ask my friend to get me a ventilator or not? And I said, well, you're not even sick, right? Why are you thinking you need a ventilator? This is vikalpa. You know, it leads us down these amazing pathways of thought. The fourth vritti is the vritti of nidra, or sleep. And this is really interesting because we tend to think that when we sleep, the mind becomes quiet. In fact, that's not true. First of all, sleep is a covering over the self, which is part of what makes it a vritti. It can be an object of consciousness if you've ever woken up in sleep. If you've ever had lucid sleep, which some of you have, I have had a few experiences of that, you realize that the observer, when it's awake, can observe sleep. And you also know that, you know, for instance, when you're in meditation and you go into one of those dark states, like you just go out, you fall asleep in meditation, it's not that the mind is quiet, it's that the mind is dark. The mind is clouded, it's occluded. So nidra, sleep, is a vritti, and, you know, it actually is one of the vrittis that we can work with, and that it's very important to work with in a process called yoga nidra, in which we learn how to enliven our sleep so that it becomes helpful in our process rather than actually being a kind of a covering over ourself. And the fifth vritti is called memory. Smriti is a Sanskrit word. And the memory vritti is a very powerful one because it's actually the source of samskaras. Our samskaras are held in the memory. And, of course, our collective pool of memories is actually the source of our personal psyche. You are what you hold in your memory. And, of course, our memory is lodged in the physical body as well as in the subtle body. There's a wonderful book called The Body Keeps the Score about the relationship between trauma, emotional trauma, and illness. And it's why a physical practice like Hatha Yoga can trigger old traumas and emotions through the body. And it's also why it's so easy to go down the rabbit hole of our old stories. I mean, I think that, at least in my experience, and I probably in yours, you know, when we sit in meditation, very often a memory will come up. Sometimes it's a happy one, in which case we just want to follow it. For years, I used to go completely down the rabbit holes of two memory collections. One was of a particularly glamorous period in my 20s when I lived in New York and hung out with very cool people. And I would just remember these stories. You know, I remember dancing at a club, what a good time I had, what I said and what I should have said, all that stuff. And the other was a story about a family heartbreak from my childhood, which I replayed again and again and again, as many of us do, always trying to analyze it, always coming up with the same conclusions, and never really experiencing any satisfaction from it, because what was happening was that the vritti samskara chakra of memory would just be replaying itself. You know, there's a Hasidic story about an old man sitting on a train, and he's very weak. He can't really move very well, and he's sitting there saying, "Oy, my toisti." It's a Hasidic story, so he's speaking in a Yiddish accent. "Oy, my toisti. Oy, my toisti." And finally, someone else on the train gets up and brings him a cup of water, and the old man drinks it. He thanks his rescuer, and then he says, "Oy, was I toisti. Oy, was I toisti. Oy, was I toisti." So this is how it works. This is how we collect these samskaras, and we keep them going in our mind long past the time that they're of any use to us. So these five types of thinking, cleverly presenting themselves as worthy of attention, will keep surfacing and disturbing your consciousness until you commit yourself to training the mind. And this is where we get into the very heart of yogic practice, the real Yoga 101. Enthusiastic practice, which is called abhyasa, and a radical commitment to letting thoughts go, vairagya. This is how we cure the vritti samskara chakra. This is how we liberate the mind. We're going to continue using the words abhyasa, vairagya, the Sanskrit, because the English words practice, which is the usual translation of abhyasa, and non-attachment, don't convey the fullness of what these words mean. So abhyasa doesn't just mean any form of effort, though of course, life is in many ways effort, but abhyasa means yogic effort, which in Patanjali's words means making an ardent effort to retain a peaceful flow of mind free from roaming tendencies. Basically, the ardent effort to retain a peaceful flow of mind free from roaming tendencies is the constant attention to returning to your object of meditation. But it's much more than that, as we'll say in a moment. Vairagya means cultivating a mind free from the coloring of deeply embedded mental impressions. So vairagya, which I like to translate as letting go, means cultivating a mind free from the coloring of deeply embedded mental impressions. Now, as we've already said, the word for these deeply embedded impressions is vasana. The word vasana literally means coloring. Vasanas are the tendencies, as we said, that are deeper than samskaras. They color your mind, and they give your life its tone. So it's your vasanas which make you a pessimist or an optimist, a liberal or a conservative, a generous person or a tight ass, and everything that is characteristic of you. And it is actually the vasanas, the ordinary vasanas, which in large make you keep you from being the self that you know you can be. So, the big problem of life for most of us is that we're constantly being compelled to act in ways that we know are not how we really want to be. We want to be positive, we want to be calm, But we can't stop the judgments and negative thoughts that come up. You know, we know that replaying our mistakes and hating ourselves for something we did is completely useless. It doesn't help anybody. It just causes pain. But we keep letting ourselves feel guilty and remorseful again and again and again. We don't want to be insecure. We don't want to be triggered by the people around us. We don't want to be annoyed by our roommates or our children, but we can't help it. And it's because of the vasanas. They are lodged inside the citta. They have condensed and coagulated themselves inside the citta. And they determine who we are as individuals. So, you know, because all of us here on this call are people who are committed to working on ourselves, we spend a lot of time, especially if we're given to contemplation and inquiry, we spend a lot of time trying to identify our vasanas and trying to eliminate them. And, you know, and it's not that it doesn't work at all, but it only works a little bit. Because the catch-22 is that when the mind is colored by the vasanas, we actually don't have the power to see what the core issues are, much less eliminate them. And, you know, as I'm sure you know, trying to analyze your tendencies just gets you more entangled. It's kind of like the tar baby, like the old man with his glass of water. And of course, since meditation and yoga practice will often bring up buried vasanas and samskaras, you know, it's the process of sadhana very often demands that we confront stuff that is quite painful and that we would prefer not to look at. And that is one reason why sometimes when people first begin meditation and start getting a look at their vasanas, we get so scared and start to think that maybe we don't want to meditate at all. So the cure for vasana, and it's pretty much the only cure except grace itself, which is really the underpinning of all of this. The cure for vasanas is abhyasa and vairagya. And it's why abhyasa, as the sutra says, needs to be maintained over a long period of time. It needs to be maintained with no interruption and with reverence over a long period of time. This is in Sutra Book 1, Sutra 14. So basic abhyasa vairagya is committing yourself to maintaining a stable flow of mind by whatever means necessary, with enthusiasm, over and over again without interruption. Meaning, you really need to meditate every day. The word that Patanjali uses for how to do practice is asevita. Asevita means to serve or to nourish your practice. And, you know, and to serve your practice actually means to make your practice your priority, to put it ahead of all the excuses and reasons that all of us come up with to not practice. The great metaphor that the scriptures use for how to do practice is cultivating a garden. You know, when you cultivate a garden, you plant a seed, or in most cases in the modern world, a seedling. And then you water it, and you expose it to sunshine, and you fertilize it, and it grows. And it doesn't grow in 2 minutes, usually. And in order to allow the seed to grow, of course, you have to water it regularly. And you have to water it the right way. You know, some plants can't be overwatered. Some plants can't stand underwatering. So, you know, but the point is that if you just water the plant once a month, it's going to die. And it's the same with your practice. The consistency is what's important. Not so much how long you meditate, though. At a certain point, I discovered, and many people discover, that if you really want to go deep in meditation, you actually do have to sit for a long time, you know, more than half an hour. for many people, 45 minutes or an hour. But it's fine if you start with 10 minutes or 15 minutes or 20 minutes. Whatever you can do, that will allow you to sit regularly and to sit for as long as you agreed to sit. You know, my guru once wrote that the reason he was able to go deep in meditation over the years of his active sadhana was that he always sat for the amount of time that he had set for himself, no matter how bored he got, no matter how restless he got, no matter how hungry he got. If he decided to meditate for 45 minutes, he would not get up until 45 minutes had passed. And I have found that that one decision makes a huge difference. You know, and the other thing that makes a huge difference is to do it without attachment. You know, every meditation teacher in the world will tell you to practice without expectations, which is pretty much impossible. We all have expectations. But what you can do is work with your expectations through vairagya to keep noticing when an expectation is coloring your practice, when you find yourself thinking nothing's happening, this is ridiculous, or I must not be doing this right, you know, and letting it go. So Abhyasa Vairagya, this is what we're going to be working with this week during the homework. Really looking at what Abhyasa, practice conducted with reverence over a period of time, is for you or can be for you. And beginning to look at what vairagya, the practice of letting go, really is for you. You know, the other word in this sutra is satkara sevito, fully attended to with reverence. Satkara means reverence. And reverence, that is, approaching your practice not with the sense that you're doing it because it's good for you, but with the feeling that it's actually an enormous privilege to practice, and that the time of practice is a special, sacred time, not just an obligation, because, as you know, the more you can make meditation or yoga or any yogic practice that you do, the more you can surround it with a feeling of specialness, especially if you're a person who tends to be careless or cynical, the more you can make it reverent, the deeper and the more powerful your practice is going to be. And so reverence is really worth cultivating. It's one of the reasons that I always ask you to chant mantras when we begin. It's one of the reasons why I've found it so personally important to have an altar, just a space where when I sit in front of it, my mind knows that it's going to practice. And also to create an uncluttered space where you meditate. What I think many of us find is that when we come to meditation feeling reluctant or bored or, you know, like we're in a hurry, that just those moments that we take to cultivate reverence, to chant, to remember to be grateful for something in our life or for life itself, the practice becomes juicier, becomes more enjoyable, and ultimately it becomes something that we really look forward to. So we're going to end the commentary here. I want to talk a little bit more about vairagya next week. It's actually one of my favorite topics. But since the whole idea of vairagya and non-attachment is something that is kind of hard for contemporary society to fully embrace, I'm also going to ask you to contemplate when and why it's a good thing, and hopefully to discuss it with your study partner. And right now, we're just going to take a couple of minutes and go back into meditation. And we're going to do a mini process of cultivating reverence in the practice. So as you close your eyes, as you let your attention turn to the breath, see if you can feel how utterly sacred and utterly necessary the breath that gives you life really is. As you bring your awareness to the felt sense of the breath flowing in your nostrils, flowing through the nasal passages beneath the bridge of the nose, flowing up through the nasal cavity to the center of the head. Feel as though you invite the breath, as though the breath is meeting you like a lover, tenderly, caressingly, flowing into you with a lover's touch. Let yourself invite the caress of the breath and feel how when you open to that loving touch of the breath, and the breath is all about touch, there's a certain expansiveness that happens in your inner body. The tightness that comes from focus and listening in a normal way begins to dissolve, and the focus that arises is the focus that comes when you're actually loving what's happening in this moment. You're being made love to by the breath, which is Shakti herself, the loving life force of the universe, opening you as she flows gently through the nostrils, through the nasal passages, opening your head, and at the same time, by some beautiful synchronicity, opening your lungs and your heart, let yourself be made love to by the power of the Prana Shakti, the loving, enlivening breath. Thank you so much for being together with us. Have a beautiful week. I'm going to ask you to commit yourself to a daily meditation practice, and I'm going to send you a protocol which will come to you tomorrow, which will include a chant, it will include a breath focus, it will include a mantra, and it will include some instructions for cultivating reverence and duration. And through this practice and the energy that is being given to us through this gathering, you will experience the power of Abhyasa and open up to the power of Vairagya and realize how much creativity there really is in your own inner being. Thank you so much. Have a beautiful week. And don't forget to write to the listserv and share your experience and questions with the rest of us. Namaste.
Satgamaya Tamasu.